welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, it's all about the Pixel 5 because everybody seems to be talking only about the Pixel 5. But we're actually still going to talk about a lot of other things because this was a very busy week. And that does not include Prime Day, which took up all of our lives over the last 3 days. Don't really want to talk about it. But if you bought something, tell me, what did you buy? We're also going to talk a little bit about the OnePlus 8T, which is a new phone from a company with a little bit of drama. We'll get into why. And after the break, iPhone. It's like developers. Everybody gets an iPhone. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, go watch the Steve Ballmer video. You'll understand. So there's a new iPhone. In fact, there are four new iPhones. There's also a new HomePod mini, and we will get into all of that. And then at the end of the show, what's making us happy? All right, to join us this week, Joe Maring. How are you, man? Welcome back.
I'm good. It's fun to be on this a little bit more often, stretch those podcasting skills a little.
No, there's no skill involved. No, not at all. You're just talking into a microphone about random crap. At least that's what I learned from Daring Fireball listening to it this week. No, I'm joking. But also, I don't understand three-hour podcasts. Please explain to me how anybody listens to a three-hour podcast. And Hayato Huseman, welcome back to the show.
Hey. You know, my mood really is directly correlated with the weather. So right now I'm feeling pretty gray, cold, and rainy. But we're most of the way through like the big surge of Techtober. So there's a positive.
It is true. We are almost through October, or halfway through, I guess, starting today. Or when you're listening to this, it'll be more than halfway. And I have to say it's gray and rainy and cold and messy and miserable, and I have a headache. But we're doing this anyway because people expect an AC podcast every week.
Can this just be an hour podcast of us complaining? I would love that.
You would, actually.
There's an idea.
I don't know if everybody else would, though. But it is interesting because I think it was earlier this year when, you know, there were a few weeks that we didn't record. We were recording every 2 weeks. It wasn't that consistent. I made a promise to the listeners, and I said, we will record every week unless something, you know, crazy happens and there's an emergency and we just can't do it. And we've stuck to it. And we are, after this, four episodes away from from our 500th episode, which is absolutely bananas. And I am not sure what we're going to do, to be honest. We still have to figure that out. It'll be sometime in November, but stay tuned for more information. All right. That's the show. See you later, everybody. No, we'll talk a little bit about the Pixel 5. Hayato, you and I kind of shared responsibilities on this. Alex did the video, but you did a bunch of the photo samples. You took all the amazing photos in the review. You've spent some time with it. So I would like to know what you think of the phone and whether people should think about it in the same way as they thought about the Pixel 4, the Pixel 3, and all the other flagships that Google's released over the last few years.
Yeah, so I said a few weeks ago in the podcast that I wasn't really excited for the Pixel 5, and as is often the case, I'm happy to have been wrong. I really, really like this phone. It's cheaper than a lot of the phones that have come out lately, especially the ones that I've been reviewing. You know, lots of phones that cost over $1,000. This one's only $700, which saying only sounds insane considering how cheap phones used to be. But this one is a very affordable flagship tier phone. And it's sort of everything you would expect, good and bad, I would say, about a Pixel phone, right? So the specs are nothing crazy. The cameras are great, but maybe not quite as improved as we might have hoped. But I think my overall take with the Pixel 5 is that it's one of the friendliest phones released this year. And by that, I mean, it's just a very comfortable phone. You know, it's got rounded corners and a nice size that fits well in your hand. It's very, you know, generally fast and responsive and reliable. They really just kind of nailed all of the basics. And I think that's what's most important to get right in a phone these days. And everything else, you know, is sort of secondary. But the Pixel has always had some kind of major flaw that keeps it from being like an easy recommendation. And I think for the first time, that's just not the case this year. And I'm really, really happy about that.
So you got the sort of sage color like I did. What's your take on that? because I'm kind of in love with this color, to be honest, but I know it's been a little divisive, especially if somebody liked, say, the Oso orange, you know, really pop out color versions of the Pixels from years past. What's your take on this more subtle colorway?
Well, you know, I don't need my phone to look like a traffic cone, so I don't really miss the orange. But I really like the sage. I think this year has been a big year for different shades of blues and greens in general, and sort of any of the colors in between those two. And I really like the sage. I still think my favorite finish that's been showing up on phones has been something like the Nebula Green, I think it's called, on the OnePlus 8 Pro. But I really, really like this sage, the fact that it's this you know, sort of matte texture with a little bit of a speckle on it. So you can kind of feel little bits of the back of the phone that are raised just a touch. It's a really, really nice finish. I like it a lot.
Yeah, let's actually talk about that aluminum finish, because until I used the phone, I wasn't sure what that would mean, right? We've had aluminum phones for years. HTC famously released a slew of them, and you know, it came and went, right? As wireless charging got more popular, and I guess the reality of the industry changed. The iPhone moved to glass, Samsung phones moved to glass, therefore kind of everybody felt the pressure to do that. We're back to this point now where there's a variety of materials used in high-end phones, and we're not seeing a lot of metal phones anymore, but this one is it's 100% recycled aluminum, and there's a plasticky paint on top of it. So it does add a bit of texture, as you mentioned. But yeah, this does not feel like a metal phone. It does feel like any phone that I've actually used before. And if you're going to put this in a case, you know, by all means, do it. But I don't feel like I really need to. It doesn't have I don't feel the same vulnerability of using it as I do with something like, you know, a really expensive glass slab, like basically every other $1,000 plus phone on the market.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's this level of confidence in sort of the weight behind the phone. So even though the back doesn't necessarily feel like you don't have that cold metal touch that you would expect on something like an HTC from a few years ago. But it still has that heft of a metal body. It doesn't feel quite like a lot of the plastic phones that we've also surprisingly seen, you know, have this sort of comeback lately with like the S20 FE and the Galaxy Note 20. It doesn't quite feel like those. There's the weight to it. So I do think it feels like still very sturdy, despite not quite feeling like the metal material that it does actually use. I think the funniest thing about the design of this phone is the fact that, like you said, we've sort of lost aluminum backings just to features like wireless charging. And when they announced that this metal phone has wireless charging in both directions, you know, wireless and reverse wireless, we were all sort of just racking our brains trying to figure out how did they do this magic that everybody said couldn't be done. And really the answer was just this super simplistic, like, oh, we just kind of cut a hole in the back and, you know, basically made that part actually plastic.
Yeah. I mean, only Google would do that, right? Release a phone that's 100% aluminum, figure, oh, now we have to make a phone that wirelessly charges as well. So instead of refactoring the entire plan, let's just cut out a little hole, cover it with plastic, and then paint the whole thing so it feels like neither of those two materials.
As someone that hasn't used the phone, like, I'm assuming you can, but like, I'm guessing there's no like different feeling in the back, like where you can tell where that the hole cutout is for the Qi charging contact area.
It's very uniform. I've not felt it.
There's no way. I mean, look, if Google had done that and you could tell, you know, sometimes if you hold like a phone with a optical fingerprint sensor to the light, you can see through the display. You know, the OLED is translucent, so you can see through it and actually, oh, there it is. There's no way you can do that with this because the paint layer is thick enough. It's fully opaque, and it's just, they clearly understood the problem and addressed it early on. My issue is, if there is one, over time, will this scratch? And if so, will it wear the paint down to the point where it may be more vulnerable in that one position, right? Like, I can't wait for Jerry Rig Everything to do a teardown of this, because when you take off all that paint, is there just literally a hole there? Or, I mean, not, obviously it's covered in a what they call a bioresin, but if you scrape away that portion, is it possible to just see through to the phone? Or is there another protective layer? Because this is IP68 water and dust resistance, so resistant. So you would think that Google went out of its way to ensure that there are multiple layers of protection before anything gets to that part of the frame.
I do want to ask, though, if you've run into the same thing where, as glad as I am that it has wireless charging, I'm more glad that it has reverse wireless charging, because I find that more useful for charging things like, you know, true wireless earbuds than I do for sort of the typical wireless charging and topping up the phone very slowly. But have you found that the wireless charging coil on the Pixel 5 is a bit hard to find with certain wireless chargers? Like, I use mine on the old Samsung like convertible wireless charging pad thing, and it works just fine with my phone just like laying on top of it. But once I switch the charger to the vertical stand, it can't find it on the Pixel 5. Like, I just can't charge it vertically.
I haven't. I've only used it on a few chargers, actually. Funnily enough, the only chargers I've used it on are from Nomad. So I guess they just make chargers with enough coils that it hits it at some, you know, at any angle. But yeah, I haven't had any issues wirelessly charging this thing. I mean, it is a little disappointing that there's only 18 watt charging, given that the OnePlus 8T this week came out with a phone that charges from 0 to 100 in like 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So this has a 4,080 milliamp-hour battery, which we can talk about in a little bit. But given that Google didn't increase the speed of the charging, it just means that the phone's going to take longer to charge than any other Pixel, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, it's not my favorite thing. But I mean, also, I guess we can just get right into the battery conversation if you want. Like, I found that I don't have to really worry about charging at midday. So like, I'm not too worried about the charging speeds, because it can last me up until nighttime, no problem. And, you know, like, by the time I go to bed, it doesn't really matter how quickly it charges.
Obviously, that is the best part of this phone, right? Like, you had a Pixel 4 that, in every other way, like, if in a parallel universe, if Google had figured out that the Pixel 4 needed a large battery and it lasted more than 7-8 hours, then it would have, none of this would have happened, right? They may not have released the Pixel 5 in its current form. But after the Pixel 4 bombed, it didn't sell in the numbers Google wanted to. We know through extensive reporting that Rick Osterloh, who leads the hardware division at Google, sort of saw the outcry from users, brought the product managers of the Pixel line into his office, and basically said, like, WTF, mates, like, let's, for like, the big question was, why didn't he know about it from the beginning, for one? But second, the fact that it got to market with batteries that size and that poorly calibrated, you know, they obviously had to make battery life a priority in the Pixel 5. And it is. It's so much better. You don't even have to think about it. But that's kind of true of every other phone now, right?
Yeah.
If you look at just the numbers for the batteries, like between the Pixel 5 and the 4A 5G, that like you're technically getting the larger, like 4,080 milliamp hour unit, and like this physically smaller Pixel 5, where the 4A 5G is like a little over 3,800 milliamp hours. And just like the 4,000 milliamp hour size in general for the Pixel 5, if you compare that to like the 2,800 capacity in the Pixel 4, it's like kind of mind blowing, just like the year over year differences that they made in that department.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just glad that, you know, I think for the last couple of years, ever since Google pushed out the A line, the conversation has always been like, well, the A series has great battery life, but you can't get through half a day with the normal Pixels. Like, why is that? And now finally you can have the highest end Pixel and actually have good battery life. It's such a relief because I mean there's the A series is great. It's really fantastic, but there's no reason for the higher end version to have just the insanely bad battery life last year's model did.
Well, there's also the question of like Google made the decision to hit a certain price point. And we have to mention that a lot of people have been comparing the Pixel 5 to the Nexus 5, right? The Nexus 5 was a $400 phone. It did everything pretty well, but nothing outstanding. You know, it was released 7 years ago. And back in 2013, end of 2013, LTE was just coming into its own. The chips at the time were becoming more efficient. Famously, Google released the Nexus 4 without LTE, but it actually did have LTE if you hacked it, because they released it with a Qualcomm baseband that supported it, but it was so inefficient that Google just disabled it altogether. But if you knew what you're doing and the phone had bands that supported it in your area, you could turn on LTE. So I did. I turned on LTE on my Nexus 4, and the battery life just bombed, obviously. It couldn't handle it. But the Nexus 5, it was plastic, it was thin, it was light, it was really well designed. The cameras weren't good, but they were better than the ones in the Pixel 4 and the Nexus 4. But overall, I think people just loved it because it was a very simple, approachable phone, right? It did everything you needed it to do for $400. If you take that price and you inflate it to 2020 numbers, you do get around $650, $700. And when you take into account the 5G tax, which I kind of want to talk about a little bit, in the US version of the Pixel 5, this is very much a rebirth of the Nexus 5 in that Google is going for simplicity, it's going for experience over specs, and largely it's just appealing to people who want a phone that works. And as you said, Hayato, early on, this is the first Pixel that doesn't have any show-stopping bugs. It's the one phone that I can look at in Google's Pixel line, the flagship line, and be like, nope, no big errors, no big problems, no big memory concerns, no big battery concerns, no big screen concerns, just a solid phone.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely utilitarian. And if you know, if what you're after is like this super flashy phone with a 50x camera or, you know, a folding or swiveling display or something like that, you're obviously not going to get that here. But if all you want is just a really reliable, consistent phone that does pretty much everything well, that's exactly what you get with the Pixel 5. And you get that for, again, hundreds less than you would pay for pretty much any other flagship phone that's come out this year, with, you know, maybe a few exceptions from companies like OnePlus or Samsung's more recent Fan Edition and other plastic phones. But it's really well priced, I think, even though I have seen some people argue that it's still a little more expensive than it should be. I think it sits right where it should.
Totally. Well, okay. Joe, I want to bring you into this because there are a lot of phones that are competing with this at the $700 price. And earlier this year, I didn't see that coming. You know, it kind of felt like we were either going to have the $250 Moto G Power and the $1,200 Galaxy S20 Plus, right? There didn't seem to be a lot of competition in the middle, except for the iPhone 11, right? That was the $700 behemoth that sold more than every other phone in the world. We know that the iPhone 11 is the best-selling phone in the world. In the Android space, it's the Galaxy A51, which is a $400 phone. That's not a good product, period. Samsung subsequently released the Galaxy A71, which is also, I think, $500, much better product. But now we have a ton of competition in the $600-$700 space. We have sticking with Pixel for a sec, we have the $350 Pixel 4a. It's released earlier this summer. Amazing product. Really, really good. Super popular. Now we have the $500 Pixel 4a 5G. We have the $700 Galaxy S20 FE, We have the newly announced OnePlus 8T, which is 750. We have the Nokia 8.3 5G, which is also $700. There are a lot of phones in this price range right now. When you take a step back and look at which one provides or ones provide the most value, the most of what the companies are promising, which one strikes you as the best deal?
Right now, anyways, it's probably the S20 FE. I'm usually not like the biggest fan of Samsung phones just because One UI isn't my kind of favorite flavor of Android. But it's one of those phones, kind of like the Pixel 5, where there just isn't anything about the phone that's noticeably bad or like seriously flawed. It's basically like the same experience you get with the regular $1,000 S20. It's that 120 hertz AMOLED display that looks fantastic, obviously, because it's a Samsung phone. You're getting that Snapdragon 865 processor, which has been the heart of just about every flagship Android phone this year. Cameras are solid, battery life is really strong, and there's, like I said, the whole experience, like, there's nothing about it that feels like it's a lesser phone compared to any of the other S20 models. It feels like a legitimate flagship. And I've absolutely, like, been loving my time using it. I've got a lawn chair on there just to kind of mimic that Pixel experience to make me feel a little bit more at home. But I mean, like, it's fast, it's responsive, like, I don't have battery issues, it's a reliable shooter for photos here and there. And, like, the Pixel 5, like, I wrote an editorial just talking about how, like, I've been using the S20 FE for a few days, and, like, I no longer care about the Pixel 5. And I feel like that's probably going to be true for, like, average consumers or most shoppers, just because, like, you know that Samsung name, like, it's an insanely good price. Like, they're going to compare this to an S20 or S20 Plus, see, there's this multiple $100 price difference, and you're effectively getting like a very, very similar phone. And I think for most people, that's probably the best choice and is most definitely going to sell like hotcakes for Samsung. Like, I'd be really surprised if this thing flops in any regard. A little part of me is still kind of yearning for the Pixel 5 just because, like, there's something almost intangible for me about using a Pixel phone with that software experience and like the way those photos are processed. But like, as an overall package, like, at least right now, that FE is kind of sticking out to me. And like, who knows, like, when that Nokia phone gets here and what, you know, what else is happening with the iPhone 12 mini and all this stuff. But that's at least been my experience using it. I don't know about like Hayato. I know you've used the Pixel 5 and the S20 FE, like, if you've got any differing thoughts there, but
I think you've just nailed it. I mean, the S20 FE has a lot of advantages over the Pixel 5 in terms of, one, they've, you know, Samsung's already put it on a $100 discount at basically every retailer. So unless that's changed in the last couple of days, you know, last I checked, it was about $600, where it's normally supposed to be $7. And, you know, it comes in all these fun colors. It's got wider carrier availability. It has one extra camera over the Pixel 5. So you still get a telephoto and an ultra wide. Like, it's got a lot of advantages. And I think the vast majority of people never cared about the Pixel phones anyway. So, you know, there's going to be a lot more brand recognition with the S20. Even if, you know, the whole fan edition FE branding doesn't really have much clout right now, that phone is definitely going to sell better. And I think it's just as good of a phone, if not maybe better, for general consumers. Just because, again, you get those extra cameras, you get, I think most people are more comfortable with Samsung software. And the cameras, even though they're not quite my cup of tea, it's still like the shots you get out of a Samsung phone are very like vibrant and sort of Instagrammable right out of the box, where the Pixel, I think it appeals more to like actual photographers, but not so much people that like that don't want to take the extra time to edit their photos. Like, if you just want to shoot and just put your images straight on like Instagram or whatever else, I think Samsung's sort of image processing is a bit more efficient in that way, and it's a bit more appealing to people.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's a question that the Pixel 5 is a better camera than the Galaxy S20 FE. It's a better camera than the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra for the most part. It's a better camera than anything else out there in the sense that it is more reliable to just open the camera app, take a photo of something, and trust that it'll give you a really good shot. Specifically, and I bring this up every opportunity I can, it is a better camera for people of people and therefore for people. It does not mess with faces. And I want to make clear here that it is not about face smoothing, right? A lot of people have, when I mention this, they say it's a cultural difference between the East and the West, and Samsung is trying to appeal to both by smoothing faces in its cameras, in its processing. And you can sort of override it by going to the pro mode, sort of, but not entirely. But the reality is that Samsung, in so doing, is removing detail that it should be your decision whether you want to remove, period, right? You are taking detail, you are taking information away from the camera. And it is not that Samsung doesn't do this for other objects, right? It does not soften dog's fur, or it doesn't soften, you know, the lines in like the bark of a tree or the contours of a car, right? It just does this for people. And I don't understand it, right? It's not about Samsung having a worse camera, because really, if you compare the size of the sensor, the amount of light hitting it, all of those factors, Samsung shouldn't have that much of a disadvantage over something like the Pixel 5. But it does, specifically when it comes to people.
I think the weird thing about their face smoothing is that, you know, you can call it a cultural difference or whatever you want to call it, but they give you the option in the settings or just in the camera software, you can turn off face smoothing, but even once you set it to zero, it still does it. It's just not as strong, but it's like clearly still happening. You can watch it happening when you point the camera at yourself versus if you quickly put it at something else. It just like that smoothing feature goes away.
Well, that's only for the front camera. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Again, like I've done comparisons. I've taken photos of people with the rear cameras. I've changed it to pro mode. It does still soften faces. And I can't help but believe that at this point, it has to be an editorial decision, right? This is not Samsung saying, oh, you know, our cameras just capture different information, or we prioritize one, you know, color science over another, for example. This is information that you cannot get back once it's lost. So for my purposes, I take photos of my kid all the time. I want to know that the photo that I'm taking can be softened after the fact if I want it to. And it really does make a difference to me. To other people, maybe it doesn't. But even then, take out faces from the conversation. Hayato, I just think the Pixel takes better photos more often than a Galaxy S20 FE.
I agree. I mean, I think in general, that's definitely the case. I enjoy the photos from my Pixel phones a lot more than I do from Galaxy phones. But I think where Samsung does have an advantage, especially like you brought up the Note 20 Ultra, and on that phone and some of Samsung's other, you know, recent flagships, they just have these enormous sensors that, you know, whether you like or dislike their image processing, there's so much more natural depth to the photos, this sort of almost, you know, almost natural portrait mode, just from the real bokeh that's happening in the photos, just that blurry, you know, depth of field. And that's something that the Pixel has to some degree, but, you know, if you really want that crazy effect that you can get just naturally with something like the Note 20 Ultra, you do have to switch to portrait mode and sort of depend on this algorithms to really figure out for you.
Yeah.
So I think the, you know, Samsung's phones have that sort of advantage as far as just like raw specs and you know, these giant lenses and sensors go. The other thing that I think really isn't great on the Pixel's camera, unfortunately, is the telephoto on the Pixel 5, since they got rid of that telephoto lens. You know, we've all been clamoring for an ultra wide on a Pixel since the dawn of the Pixel, right? We've wanted that. And now we have it, and it's good, but the ultra wide is really nothing spectacular, I think. And the zoom that you get now from having to do digital zoom versus having a dedicated telephoto lens, it's really not good compared to last year's Pixel 4. You know, I've taken a few side by sides, and there's just this massive drop in quality when you look at 2x telephoto shots from the Pixel 4 versus, you know, the Pixel 5 is just digital cropping. Mm-hmm. I would say if you take a lot of zoomed photos, that's a really strong setback of the Pixel 5 right now.
Totally. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, just from sheer information captured at the source, the Pixel is years behind, and it's years behind on purpose, because just Google approaches things from a software perspective in a way that no other company does, but that in turn informs their hardware decisions, right? They know the sensor inside and out. This IMX663 is the same or a variant of the same sensor they've had for basically 5 years now. The first Pixel didn't have this sensor, but the second one had the IMX362, which was practically identical to the one in the Pixel 3 and above. So every single Pixel since 2017 has had, for all intents and purposes, the same camera sensor. The Pixel 3 beefed up the aperture a little bit to f1.7, so it's slightly wider, and now we just have that same hardware every year. I agree with you that trading out the telephoto for an ultra-wide has its pros and cons, and I can see it from both sides of this of the argument. Personally, I like the ultra wide. I like having it there, but comparing telephoto side by side with the Pixel 4, I kind of miss not having that sure thing, right? Because not only does a 2x zoom just look better on a Pixel 4, but a 5x zoom looks way better on a Pixel 4, because the more you extrapolate and crop in, the worse a Pixel 5 is going to look with that 1x, you know, with that main point of view.
I'm with you that I prefer the ultra wide, but I do think, again, if somebody is buying the Pixel 5 and they really prioritize, if they take a lot of zoom photos, I don't think it's going to be the right option. I'm not going to say you're better off with the Pixel 4, because that battery life is just not worth any camera. But I think if telephoto is your priority, then I don't know, maybe you should look at a different phone instead of the Pixel this year.
I'll say, from like a general, like, quote unquote, regular consumer outlook too, like, if, like, we all know, like, and compare these phones side by side, that like Google, like the way Google processes its images, like, we know that like they look darn good, and we kind of have like a preference for that. But if you're going to like a carrier store or shopping online, and it's like both phones have like pretty similar primary and ultra wide cameras, but like the Galaxy S20 FE, you do get like a legit telephoto sensor, which can go all the way up to 30x, I believe, using like the combination of optical and digital zoom. And you've got like a legit pro mode and all these shooting modes and stuff. And, you know, people are probably familiar with Samsung's kind of oversaturated, very warm and colorful image processing. So I like, even if there's the, you know, the issue with the face smoothing and all that, I feel like as just a regular shopper, someone that doesn't, you know, follow this stuff as closely as we do, just kind of like side by side, the S20 FE at first glance, at least, is probably the more appealing option. Like if you start to like dig into it a bit more, like, you, some people would probably find that they have like a preference for the way the Pixel shoots. But I mean, for, as someone that probably just wants like a camera for casual shooting and can get all the features they would probably expect, like, I would maybe argue that it's probably the better solution, even if I don't personally prefer the way some of those images turn out compared to like a Pixel or something.
Yeah, completely agreed. Especially because it's not like the, you know, we prefer the Pixel cameras, but it's not like the S20 FE takes bad photos by any means. You know, it's still got great cameras. So I totally agree.
So I will 100% agree with you. That's the reason I titled my review, which you should go read, "The Best Pixel Ever, Not the Best Phone," but not the best phone, right? Because this is a phone that checks all the boxes, and yet the competition is catching up faster than the Pixel itself is improving, and in some ways has surpassed the competition. In some ways has surpassed Google. There are a few Pixel-only advantages still, right? You get software updates as soon as they're available. You get monthly security patches. You get these quarterly feature drops. You get the recorder app. You get some cool stuff in the Google Photos editor, like Portrait Light, which I think is astounding and just such a cool show. Like, it's just such a brag of Google to be able to do this, applying realistic lighting effects after a photo is taken, even on photos that are not taken with a pixel. Like, come on. It's crazy how they can do
that. It's wild.
But there are not that many of these things that we can point out anymore, right? And the Pixel is now just a solid mid-range phone. And I want to talk about price for a sec before we move on to the OnePlus 7 8T, because we know based on exchange rates that this is a $700 phone that should be a $600 phone. What I mean by that is, if you take the price of the Pixel 5 in Canada, where I live, it's $800. If you take the price of the Pixel 5 in the UK, in Australia, in markets that do not have millimeter wave, Google is charging about the equivalent of $100 less in those markets than they are in the States. And the only thing that you can point to, the only major difference, is that the Pixel 5 in the States supports millimeter wave 5G on all of its, on the only SKU that's available. It did not make a Verizon-specific version like some other OEMs did. And what that means is that Google could have sold this for $600 and given everybody else sub-6 5G and then charged Verizon customers $100 more and left it at that and made this a $500 phone or $600 phone. But they chose not to. And I'm very curious about that decision.
And it's especially frustrating because they did exactly that with the Pixel 4a 5G. If you buy it unlocked, it's just the sub-6 model, which is $499. But if you get the millimeter wave UW Verizon variant, it's $599. So like they clearly like could have done that, but like they made an obvious decision to do the opposite for the Pixel 5. And like it could have been maybe it would be too similar in price to the 4a 5G, and they wanted to make it stand out as like a more expensive or a more of a flagship phone. But it is definitely unfortunate to know like there could have been a world where this was a $599 phone, and then compared to like an S20 FE or a OnePlus 8T, it would have been way more compelling in that regard.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we'll come back to this when we talk about the iPhone 12s, because Verizon 5G plays a big part of that conversation. But I do want to talk quickly about the OnePlus 8T. This is a phone that was announced literally at the same time as the embargo lifted for the Pixel 5. So in the hubbub of Wednesday morning, the OnePlus 8T was announced. There was a big online event, and the embargo lifted at the end of the launch, which was about 10:45, so Eastern, so it's 15 minutes before. We had reviews go live of the 8T on the site and on YouTube. And then at 11, we had our video go live of the Pixel 5. So the 8T just kind of got buried. It got buried in Prime Day stuff. It got buried in Pixel 5 stuff. It just didn't get the same pickup that we normally see from a OnePlus phone. And I have to wonder, Joe, what is your take on this, right? OnePlus does this every year. It releases a mainline phone, now two mainline phones in, you know, the spring, early summer, and then follows it up with one in the fall with a few improvements. The 8T, though, feels, in my opinion, a little bit too much like the OnePlus 8. And that's why it doesn't really stand out in this very crowded market.
Yeah, just this afternoon, I was writing our OnePlus 8T versus OnePlus 8 comparison. And like there are only two real differences, and that's that you get a 120 hertz refresh rate on the 8T, where the regular OnePlus 8 is set at 90 hertz, which is still like very good. You're still getting a fast refresh rate no matter which phone you get. And then you're getting which I'm sure we might want to talk about a little bit more, but the Warp Charge 65 charging on the 8T, which gives you 65 watt charge speeds compared to the 30 watts on the OnePlus 8, which according to OnePlus, you get from 0 to 100% in about 39 minutes, which is really, really impressive if that's like a spec you're concerned about. But outside of those two things and like some minor tweaks to the ultrawide camera and the macro camera, like it's basically the same phone. Value-wise, it's about $50 cheaper if you compare it to the 12 gig of RAM and 256 gigabyte storage variant of the regular OnePlus 8. So, I mean, you're getting a little bit better phone for about $50 less if you were already thinking about buying a higher tier version of the OnePlus 8. But especially like we're talking about, where there's so many phones coming out in this $600 to $700 price bracket between the S20 FE or the Pixel 5, it makes the OnePlus 8T look kind of boring. Just because like for years and years, they've had this big differentiator of like they were priced considerably lower than other flagship phones. And that's something that's kind of been diminishing year after year. But it feels especially damning this year when Google and Samsung are really targeting this this price range of theirs like we haven't seen before. And it's not to say like the 8T is a bad phone. Like the OnePlus 8 was a really good phone. This is a slightly better OnePlus 8, so it's going to be a really good phone. But at least for me, as someone that like genuinely, like generally enjoys OnePlus phones, it is a little difficult to get excited about this one the way I have for some past OnePlus releases.
Hey, Otto, you know, you used the OnePlus 8. I think you reviewed it. What was your, you know, what's your read on what where OnePlus is right now in terms of its product line? You know, you have the OnePlus 8 Pro, which is still going on. It was still on sale. There's no OnePlus 8T Pro. There's OnePlus Nord, which isn't available in the US, but it might be later on this year. We've heard rumors. You know, where does OnePlus fit in the market right now? A couple of years ago, we saw OnePlus as being the sort of upstart that was coming in and stealing LG's lunch and giving Samsung a run for its money. And it got a T-Mobile and a Verizon deal, and it was selling at the carriers. And then that kind of faded. We saw that they didn't sell as well at the carrier level as they would have liked. They doubled down on unlocked. They, you know, this phone is only being released at T-Mobile, not Verizon. So step back from, you know, the phone itself and give me your impression of OnePlus as a company right now.
It's a little weird to watch them, you know, go from being the brand of, you know, the flagship killers to now I feel like they've kind of just become like everybody else in a sense, right? Like they've got, just like Samsung and LG and everybody else, they've got cheap phones, they've got expensive phones, they've got, you know, sort of mid-range devices somewhere in between. And it's, I don't know. I mean, I've always enjoyed OnePlus phones, especially because I just really like Oxygen OS being like a slightly more customizable version of stock Android, basically. But with some of their newer phones, I mean, these things are priced just as expensive or you know, in the case of the Pros, even more expensive than phones like the Pixel 5 and Galaxy S20 FE. And really, what more are you getting for that extra money? Where it, like there used to be this hugely clear difference of value, right? Like it used to be every OnePlus phone is just like, oh, you get the features of a $1,000 phone, but this one costs $550 or whatever. And I think that's becoming less and less the case, and they're just sort of becoming another big manufacturer, which I guess is in some way inevitable. But it's just, it's harder and harder for me to be excited about OnePlus phones the way I used to be right now.
Especially on the software front too. Like Oxygen OS has like for years and years been one of like outside of the Pixels, like one of my favorite ways to use Android. And then like we've got the Android 11 update with Oxygen OS 11, and it's for all intents and purposes like a copycat design of what Samsung does with One UI. And it makes sense from OnePlus's perspective, because if they're trying to appeal to people that are familiar with Samsung phones, they're familiar with how those phones operate, having their software be more reminiscent to that is probably an easier transition for them.
I mean, you look at the back of the phone, it looks exactly like an S20 Plus.
Yeah, too. Yeah, it's just, I can't blame them, I guess, for wanting to do that, because I'm sure it makes sense from a business and a numbers perspective, but it does kind of take away that, I don't know, like the unique identity or the originality that the company used to have. And it's probably just a side effect of them coming into their own and being more of a, not that they weren't a legitimate company, but just the effect of them growing and expanding to where they are now. And it just kind of feels more of like a generic run-of-the-mill flagship, like you said, where before there was a real uniqueness and something about the phones that like wasn't like anything else you could buy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like especially you look in some of their main fan bases, like India in particular has always just loved OnePlus phones. And now, you know, we're kind of getting to the point where, even in India, people are just kind of looking at the OnePlus phones now, and they're like, well, this is overpriced these days. Look what I can get from X other manufacturer for half the price.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the exact same position that they used to, you know, sort of like they're in the position of the companies that they used to target with their own phones. And it's I don't know. It's I still really like OnePlus. I'm still rooting for them, but it's
oh, yeah.
I don't know. These phones are just more and more of sort of what we've already been seeing from other companies.
Yeah, like maybe with the Nord, like we get like that's obviously targeting like lower prices and stuff. So maybe there'll be kind of like a resurgence for the whole flagship killer mantra that way. But I mean, who knows where all that's heading?
Yeah,
I think what's obvious though is that we're in a period of transition right now where a company is having to they're being forced to choose between 5G and other important specs, right? And in order to hit the price points that they're hitting, they're sacrificing other parts. And there was no question that with a Snapdragon 865 and the OnePlus 8T, it would support 5G. And then we have no wireless charging, right? Or you have no official water resistance. You know, small things that OnePlus could have done to make this phone more compelling. But I also do think that we're just reaching a point of saturation in this market where it's pretty difficult to buy a bad phone. You know, Joe, you talk a lot about how Motorola sort of got that value side of the market cornered in the U.S. We know this from our own reporting and from, you know, the traffic on our various buyer's guides, that Motorola is the phone that you think of, or Motorola's Moto G phones are the ones you think of when you think of value in the U.S., right, for under $300. The Pixel 4a is probably the best value proposition of a non-5G phone you can find today in the U.S. And whenever we talk about this, people from Europe, from India, from literally every other market laugh in our face because Vivo, Oppo, and Xiaomi don't exist, right? There's just so much less competition in the West because those companies do not factor into the conversation. And, you know, you have to think OnePlus priced its Nord, its 8 series so much lower in India because of all that competition. And I guess it just comes down to the fact that we are still subject to the way people buy phones in this country through the carriers, subsidized on a 2-year contract. And as long as that is the case, phone prices are going to rise because we can more easily justify spending $70 a month than $1,400 or whatever the hell it is. And it also means that there just won't be that enormous appetite for that mid-range the way that there are in other countries, even though right now, during a pandemic, people are being way more price conscious than they ever have before.
Do you guys ever see that really changing in the U.S., though? Like, I know we've kind of gone from contracts to now every carrier, you know, has you finance the phone. So the full price of a phone is a bit more transparent these days. But do you think we're ever going to hit a point like in other countries where people just kind of look at the full price and they spend the actual money on the phone, just buy it up front or whatever the case, maybe put it on a credit card instead of, you know, looking at a phone and being like, oh, well, this is only $35 a month, you know?
No, it's learned behavior, right? Where we're told that you put things, there's a system in place that encourages financing, right? Through credit, the institutions, the infrastructure is there. And it doesn't seem like that's going to change anytime soon. What is interesting, though, is that we haven't seen the same thing in other markets, right? I'd love to hear, actually, if you're in the UK, if you're in France or Germany or somewhere in Europe, how do you buy your phones? Do you buy them outright or do you finance them? Because I know that in the UK, at least, the price of the phone is based on the plan that you buy. So you can buy a SIM-free, you know, a phone at a SIM-free price for whatever it costs. But then there's also like you buy an iPhone 12 with a 5 gig a month plan, and that is the cost of your phone, right? It's not...
Yeah.
it's not necessarily unbundled the way that it is in the US. So yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think it'll change in the US as long as the carriers have as much power, continue to have as much power as they do. Which,
well, and I think that's really part of why we don't have any real competitors in that, you know, super low price sort of range, is that even a phone that comes out for, you know, $200-$300, or we'll go back to the Pixel 4a and say, you know, here's a really great phone for $350. I think most Americans see that as, well, that's still like, that's $350 I have to spend right now. Why would I do that when I can just buy, you know, this $1,000 phone? But they don't think about it that way. They say, you know, I could just get this for $25-$30.
Yeah. I mean, to bring it back to OnePlus, like, that's basically what happened to them as they got bigger. Like, you had the OnePlus 1, the OnePlus 2, and all those phones where, like, they had to appeal to that real, like, techie demographic of, like, you're getting, like, the latest Snapdragon processor, it's $300 or whatever, and, like, that was their big thing. But, like, last year's, or I guess this year's OnePlus 8 release, if you went to the OnePlus website, like, on launch day, they were promoting, like, Verizon, T-Mobile, like, whoever their carrier partners were, like, they now are in that system where, like, they can charge more money for their phones, and, like, we can complain about OnePlus smartphones going up in price exorbitantly year after year. But I mean, like, they're in the carrier game. People aren't, if most people probably buying OnePlus phones, like, you're not spending the full amount if you're in a carrier store. Like, you're just gonna spend however much it is per month. And I mean,
yeah,
like, I would love for that to change, because it, long term, it's so much more affordable if you're just smart about it and know to buy a $500 phone or whatever, as opposed to paying month to month for something that's $1,000. But I think it would take something, some kind of radical shift or movement for that to change. And I don't envision that happening anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I worked at a carrier, I don't know, 5-6 years ago now, thankfully it's been a while, but when I worked at a carrier store, that kind of happened all the time, where, like, depending on somebody's needs, they would come in with a broken phone, and I would be like, look, you should probably buy this, I don't know, like a OnePlus phone or whatever else unlocked. It's only half the price of the other phone you're looking at. You just have to pay it all up front. And as soon as the upfront cost comes in, they're like, all right, no, I'm just, give me the cheap one right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I mean, look at an iPhone 11 Pro or something. It's $1,000, but people see that their carrier store is, you know, $49 a month, or you get a free one if you add a line. Like, it's just the method of purchasing that's just, like, so ingrained in the system. And it's just kind of the effect of, like, we've talked about, like, how much power the carriers have and the way the market operates here.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the behind-the-scenes thing, right? Companies like Samsung, in the early days and still today, they pay the stores, they pay the dealers to sell particular products. They get a kickback. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that we talk about a lot, but a Samsung has much more market power. They have much more of a marketing budget to do that, and OnePlus just does not have the same same ability to push product. I had a talk with the head of sales and marketing for LG Canada a couple of years ago, and he was very transparent about it. You know, he said, we are in a position where we're a solid number three. But we're about to, and this was back before Huawei was a big deal in North America. You know, we're a solid number three, and we're about to get kicked out of that because Huawei is coming in and they are paying dealers and carrier stores to sell their phones. So if you are Hayato at T-Mobile in 2014, you're getting $50 to $100 for every Huawei phone you sell. And that's money in your pocket, right? And that's just something that we don't think about as journalists, and we don't really think about it as consumers because we don't care. But if Hayato walks up to you and says, hey, you know, how's it going today? Can I interest you in this Samsung phone? It may be because he's a phone expert and wants to sell you the best phone, but it also may be because he's looking to get that $50 kickback. Not that you're unethical.
Sneaky,
like that, Hayato. but you know what I'm saying, right? It's unclear what their motivations are, and that's as true today as it was back then too. So
All right, I'm gonna go take a cold shower from these memories.
So I'm sorry, man. It's true though. Like, you must have had to deal with some of that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there was always pretty much every other week, you know, you would get like a different email from your higher ups that's, you know, something along the lines of, you know, hey, we've got these spiffs from different if you sell this many phones from this manufacturer or like this specific device. Then yeah, you get some kind of kickback, and it was always this incentive that, I tried not to let that, you know, change who, like what kind of phone I sold to what kind of person, but it really, obviously that's going to happen with some salespeople. Like it's, you know, it's a job and people needed to sell phones and make some extra money. So it's a definite way as a manufacturer to get yourself an advantage when it comes to market share.
Yeah, would you like more money or would you like less money?
It's literally a don't hate the player, hate the game scenario here. Like no criticism of anybody trying to hit those sales targets. No,
sure.
none at all. I am absolutely not criticizing the salespeople themselves, but the system sucks. It sucks because it rewards the people at the top. Just like most systems in the world. Let's get socialist here for a second.
Are we going to do that? Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, the systemic problems of, you know, power begets power, and that is the case here too, and the carrier system knows it, the OEM system knows it, and a company like OnePlus has actually done a really damn good job to try to get around it. And it's also why a company like Xiaomi would not work here. It wouldn't work. Everybody complains, when is Xiaomi going to bring its phones to North America? It won't work. It mm-hmm. needs the carriers. OnePlus tried it, and one could argue that it's failed so far. And that's a BBK brand, and that's probably why Vivo and Oppo will never come to North America either in any meaningful way. So it's a shitty reality that people have to deal with, that Apple and Samsung are the duopoly at the top, and that isn't going to change. Google, LG, OnePlus, Motorola, they're just, they're eating the scraps, and those scraps are pretty insignificant in the market share, from a market share perspective. So yeah, that is what it is. And it's not our, you know, we can't change it. We participate in it to some extent. And, we're also responsible for it to some extent, but.
Especially that Hayato guy. Jeez.
Yeah, that guy sucks. Should never have bought a phone from him 6 years ago. All right, let's take a break and come back and talk about one of those members of the duopoly.
Hey.
Be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. It's easy to run out of storage space on your phone. That's why we've been recommending SanDisk, the global leader in data storage solutions. I definitely could have bought a number of different USB sticks during Prime Day. There were a lot of them, but I didn't need to because I have SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive. It works with SanDisk Memory Zone app to transfer files, photos, and other important things from your phone to your USB Type-C powered flash drive. If you don't need a flash drive, SanDisk also makes the excellent Extreme microSD UHS 1 card, and both the USB-C drive and the microSD card come in storage sizes up to 1 terabyte. If you're interested in learning more about either of these amazing products, go to sandisk.com/ACP for 10% off your first order. Trust us, SanDisk makes managing your data storage simple. Learn more at sandisk.com/ACP for 10% off. That's sandisk.com/ACP. All right, Joe Maring, you are the iPhone user among us three for the most part. And as a result, I rely on you to tell me everything that you know about the iPhone 12s.
Go
small to big. Start from the little baby one and go all the way to the big maxi one.
The also, small... for my satisfaction, call them the iPhones 12.
iPhones 12.
for Renee's satisfaction.
Yeah. Yeah, we have the iPhone 12 mini, which is the small boy of the family who I am absolutely enamored with. It's Apple's touting as like their smallest and lightest 5G phone ever, because of course there's the 5G push, because that's something you get in every single model of the iPhones 12. It's got a 5.4 inch screen, which is just super tiny compared to, you know, like any, just about any other phone. Like the Pixel 5 is a relatively compact phone, and that's got a 6-inch screen, I think. So you're going down to 5.4, which, you know, some people could argue that's too small, but as someone that is has an affinity for very tiny phones and is having a very difficult time using the gigantic LG Wing right now, I'm quite looking forward to something along those lines. Regular iPhone 12 is a 6.1-inch display, so identical to the iPhone 11 from last year. Both of these are getting upgraded to AMOLED panels, though, which is really exciting because the iPhone 11 from last year was that gross LCD 720p resolution, where these are both AMOLED and they're upgraded to Full HD+, which is really nice to see. You've got dual cameras on both of them. It's a 12-megapixel sensors for both the primary and the ultra-wide camera, water resistance, wireless charging, all that good stuff. And then the 12 Pro models, there's the 12 Pro and the 12 Pro Max, which are great names. big changes there is that you're getting a stainless steel frame as opposed to aluminum frame with the regular 12s. There's telephoto cameras on those, even though there's some slight differences between how the telephoto works on the 12 Pro and the 12 Pro Max. But all phones have the A14 Bionic processor, 5G, like I mentioned earlier. And they're going back to that iPhone 4-esque design where you've got flat edges, which looks so darn nice, in my opinion. So moving away from kind of like the rounded aesthetic of the 11 series from last year, and really for basically since the 10 and maybe even before that. They've very fun colors. You've got a nice navy blue for the 12 Pro, and you've got red, blue, a nice green for the regular 12. 12 mini is kind of replacing the 11 as like the new cheap iPhone at $699, which, you know, you can get into an argument of value there compared to like a Pixel 4a or a Pixel 4a 5G. $799 for the iPhone 12. And then if you go to the Pro series, it is $999 for the iPhone 12 Pro, which is the same price as the 11 Pro from last year, but Apple is finally going to 128 gigs as the base storage for that, as opposed to 64 gigs. And then $1099 for the 12 Pro Max. They're doing a lot of interesting stuff with video because that's kind of been one of the strong suits for iPhones for a few years now. And maybe Hayato can talk a little bit more about what's going on there, but it seems like, you know, Apple's making a big push that this is the first phone I think you can record Dolby Vision and HDR video right on the phone. So like they're appealing to the pro videographer side of it with the Pro series. They're appealing to kind of like the more general consumer base with the $699 and $799 mini and the regular 12. I mean, their iPhones, they're pretty familiar. They've just got kind of like the tweak design and the new small model. But it's about what we were expecting, which is, you know, Apple's first batch of 5G phones, little camera upgrades here and there. It's going all OLED. So, I mean, like, if you like your iPhones, there's not too much to complain about here.
I'm so excited for all of the video stuff on the 12 Pro Max.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk a little bit about that because there's some, like, Pro Raw. I'm just going to call it Pro because why not? Pro Raw capture on the Pro models. The cameras are a little different between the two, which is weird. It's not like the iPhone 7 Plus and the iPhone 7 where like one had a secondary camera and one didn't. But there's subtle differences on the Pros. So both of them have the newer, larger 12 megapixel sensor, f1.6 aperture. The telephoto on the Pro is f2, and then the Pro Max is f2.2, so it's wider on the Pro, but the Pro can do only 2x optical and the Pro Max can do 2.5. And Google is doing this, Apple is doing this weird thing where they're measuring total optical range, which includes the ultra wide. So they're saying that it's not that it has a 2.5x optical zoom in. It's saying that it has a 5x total optical zoom range, which is insane to me. But there, people are going to get confused by that and think that the telephoto does 5x the way that, you know, something like the Note 20 Ultra does, but whatever. There's a new LiDAR scanner on both of them, which is interesting. We saw this on the iPad Pro already, and that'll make autofocus faster. It'll make AR more accurate. The telephoto has a it's just like there's very subtle differences between the two. One has better optical stabilization. One like the regular one has dual optical image stabilization. The iPhone 12 Pro Max has a sensor shift optical stabilization. I don't even know what that means, Hayato. Do you know what that means?
Not particularly, no. Not sensor shift.
It's probably just some minor difference. But talk about the video capture here, because that's what I'm really interested in. So it does HDR video up to 60 FPS, and there's a new sort of pro raw format that you can use to essentially capture video that can be edited later on in a particular specialized app. Walk us through what you expect this will do for video capture in the smartphone industry.
So one of the big things that's super appealing to me about the iPhone, I think it's only on the 12 Pro Max, is this move from 8-bit to 10-bit color, which for most people, that doesn't really mean anything. Like if you're just shooting video and you're just like, you know, again, tweeting out that video or putting it on Instagram right away, straight from the phone, that doesn't matter. It's not going to make a difference. But 10-bit in the video world is super, super important when you're color grading your footage, because it gives you so much more color depth, more color information. And so with 8-bit video, which is on most cameras these days, once you start to push the colors or even just push things like exposure, it really starts to break the image. You can see the colors start to sort of artifact. You get this like these blocks of color that just don't look great in your footage. With 10-bit, that's a lot less likely to happen because you have so much more color information. So it makes a huge difference for color grading in general. It's something that even my $2,000 Sony a7 III, like full frame giant mirrorless camera, that doesn't shoot 10-bit. It's only 8-bit. The new a7 S3 does, but mine doesn't. So 10-bit's a really, really important thing for post-production. The other thing is Dolby Vision. And Dolby Vision is I don't think this is the first phone that has Dolby Vision as a feature, but it's just this, basically, Dolby Vision is sort of based around HDR10. It's sort of a similar concept, but it lets you have sort of multiple layers of video. So you can have, think of it as basically you can have an HDR signal, you can have a standard dynamic range signal, and Dolby Vision basically packages them together. It offers a lot of features, really, but that's sort of its core. So you can really make things work for multiple different types of screens and displays. So having all these features together makes just for a very, very powerful camera that, you know, just fits on a phone. These are features that you really, in the dedicated camera world, a lot of these features you would have to, you know, spend thousands of dollars on a cinema camera to get these features. I mentioned my camera is about $2,000. You would have to spend a lot more than that. You know, think $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to get these features in a cinema camera. And so having these all packaged into this phone that, yes, it's expensive at, you know, $1,200, but it's still, for what you get, even though it's still going to be a phone sensor. It's not, you know, you're not working with like a full frame sensor or anything like that, but it's still just very, very impressive to see. And I'm not an iPhone guy, but I really would like to get my hands on a 12 Pro Max just so I can sort of mess with these features.
I was going to say, because like I'm not super, like, I don't know a lot about videos. So like you mentioned these are like high end, like professional grade features, but they're obviously like in a smartphone. So like, you know, regardless if it's iOS or not, do you think this is something that you would use as like a legitimate tool for like shooting video? Like if you can get these features at, you know, a lower price, even though you're working with, you know, like smaller sensors and dealing with a phone as opposed to like a legitimate camera or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the common refrain is the best camera you have is the one you have with you. And of course, this is a camera that fits in your pocket. Those cinema cameras I mentioned are enormous. You know, I mean, even my A7 III is a lot smaller than something like, you know, a Canon C200 or a RED or any of these other enormous cinema cameras. Having those kinds of powerful features in a phone, like, again, it's not going to be like amazing image quality compared to one of those cameras, but I would absolutely, like, if I'm just out, you know, say I take a vacation somewhere and I'm just out like enjoying the scenery, I want to get some really nice video that maybe I would even use in some project later on. Having all the extra flexibility that these different video features give you make it really, really compelling. Even if you're just shooting with a phone sensor, it's still, you know, being able to tweak things in post the way that this will let you, I think is super valuable.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that the industry has been talking about. When will a phone have a 1-inch sensor in it, right? The Sony RX series famously made 1-inch sensors just a common benchmark for like compact cameras, right? Pocket cameras. You know, Micro Four Thirds is slightly larger. It's, you know, an inch and a third. It has, there's, you know, APS-C, which I don't know exactly the size of the sensor. And then there's full frame, which is like the equivalent to a 35 millimeter sensor, right? So we're not quite at the 1-inch mark yet for smartphone sensors, but we're getting there. The one in the Note 20 Ultra is 1/133 inches. So it's certainly larger than the 1/2.44 inch sensor on the Pixel 5. You know, a lot of Sony's new sensors are physically much larger than they used to be. I don't know the size of the one on the iPhone 11 or the iPhone 12 Pro Max, but it seems to be significantly bigger. The literature says that it's 47% larger than the one on the iPhone 11 Pro Max. And there's, you know, a wider aperture. It's just a bigger sensor. That's exactly where the industry is going. It kind of makes me sad that Google didn't follow suit this year. But again, I don't want to retread that.
Well, and I also want to just real quick talk about the Pro RAW feature, because it's not a video feature, that's only for photos, but that's...
Yeah, I messed that up. Sorry. I was reading, I got the Dolby Vision video stuff confused with the Pro RAW, which is a photo format.
I mean, there's so much, they've got such a gigantic list of new photo or just camera features in general. It's so easy to mix them all up. but Pro RAW, I think, is actually going to be one of the bigger things that still probably won't impact like general consumers that much, but this is also a pro model, you know, like this is, at least ostensibly, it's for people that want to take advantage of these sort of more professional grade features. I think Pro RAW is a really, really cool thing to have, because what has really empowered cameras like the Pixels cameras and the iPhones cameras lately is this sort of just computing, you know, Google calls it semantic segmentation. I don't remember what Apple calls it. But basically, you know, they actively analyze all of the different things in your shot as you're taking a photo, and they choose to process different parts of your image of your image differently. And most of the time when you're shooting a raw photo, you sort of lose that extra layer of processing that your phone's camera is doing. Where, you know, say maybe your iPhone's camera sees that there's some fabric in your shot, and it sharpens the fabric without over sharpening, say, the face that's also in the shot. And when you shoot in RAW, you kind of lose that layer. But with Pro RAW, it's basically keeping that semantic segmentation in the shot while also giving you the extra flexibility that is just inherent with RAW photos. So I think that's really going to be as somebody that, like, every photo I take on my phone, I instantly throw into Lightroom if I'm going to post it somewhere. I'm really, really curious to see how much of a difference that makes, because this sort of that extra layer of processing that Apple and Google do with your photos, I think really push them that extra step to being a bit more convincing at times. You know, it can go wrong sometimes, but I think in general it does help a lot. And having all of that plus the flexibility of RAW, I think will enable some pretty great looking photos from this kind of phone.
I just realized after we talked about this, we didn't actually talk about the video improvements in the Pixel 5. So this is a good opportunity to end the show talking about those, because I actually think they're significant and kind of brings us full circle. So there's no Dolby Vision. There's no, you know, 10-bit capture on the Pixel 5, but there are a bunch of new video capture modes, and you wrote about them in the review. Thank you for that. I want you to talk about whether the Pixel 5 is now a good camera for videographers, whether you would choose this over something like a Galaxy S20.
So it's a little hard to say, because really they didn't, I didn't think Google made any sort of massive improvements to the overall video capabilities of the phone. They just sort of added new stabilization modes. So the video itself, it's a little better than it. No, set off my phone somehow. The video features on the Pixel 5, you know, the image quality itself is a little bit better than on the 4, but you still have this sort of weird handling of highlights, and it's there's little quirks to it that you don't generally find in other phones, but the stabilization modes are really neat. So there's 4 shooting modes now, basically, with video. One of them is just standard, so that's exactly what you would expect. But the other 3, you get a locked mode for shooting what is generally called a locked off shot, where basically as long as you hold the phone relatively still, you can get a shot that looks like you've just propped it up or put it on a tripod, all while shooting handheld. So the camera zooms in quite a bit, I think to 2x, and it uses the surrounding data along with, you know, some optical and electronic stabilization, and it really steadies your shot to the point where it really does look like it's on a tripod. If you tilt the phone, you can notice that sort of angle correction happening, but it's I think very well done. The other modes, you have cinematic pan, which is, I call this the mode of every shot that I did when I had a GH5 and 4K 60.
Google calls it the B-roll mode.
Exactly, yeah. I did this trick all the time. It's basically just shooting at 60 frames and giving you a 30 frames final export. So it's slowing everything down to half speed, and again, adding some stabilization. And it just makes everything, once again, handheld, it makes everything look very smooth, very, you know, moody and cinematic and whatever else you want to call it. I like that mode a lot. The mode that I don't enjoy is active mode, which is basically just a stronger version of the standard stabilization. It's there to correct against things like if you're shooting video while you're walking, or if you're running or doing anything on a moving vehicle, it corrects for that. And it does a pretty good job at steadying your shot. But the downside is that it uses the ultra-wide lens, which limits you to 1080p and also dramatically reduces the sharpness and the overall image quality. I don't think the videos that come from the active mode look good at all. But if you're in a pinch and you just really want to get a shot that would otherwise be really shaky, I suppose it comes in handy. It's the one mode that I just don't see myself using. But the other modes really do look great as these sort of easy point and shoot options. I just don't think they don't really give the Pixel necessarily a lead against other phones that just take good video out of the box.
So it's Google catching up rather than surpassing anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're doing great things with the software and with just smartly using their stabilization, but the image quality itself, I still think something like the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra takes better video. Something like the Xperia 1 Mark II has all these manual controls, as do most of LG's phones these days. having these stabilization modes is neat, but if you really want to take professional looking video on your phone, which I realize not many people necessarily do, I think having manual controls would be a lot more helpful. And being a Pixel, you still get basically zero manual control, other than you can choose between 1080p or 4K. But there's no like manual focus, there's no shutter speed or anything along those lines. And I think those would really go much further than a few like neat stabilization modes.
It's also great that Google really encourages third-party developers to build complex and accessible manual video and photo apps in the Play Store, because that would make up for it. You know, it's really nice there's, you know, you can have it both ways when you use an Android phone.
It just works.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's end the show by talking about what's making us happy this week. This is the segment where we try to end the show on a high note. We talk about something that doesn't have to be tech, but something that is making each of us happy. I will start with you, Joe. What is making you happy on this fine Thursday?
Well, I was listening to a lot of music and stuff on Tuesday and Wednesday, trying to get myself through Prime Day. And I'd forgotten that The Killers released a new album back in, I think it was August this year. It's called Imploding the Mirage, and it is absolutely fantastic. A couple of highlights from it are Dying Breed, Caution, and My God are all just wonderful alt songs, and it makes my alternative little heart very happy. I don't have a whole lot else to say about it, just because I'm not super well-versed in music, but it sounds good to my ears, and you should go listen to it, because it's good stuff.
It also makes me happy to know that you were barely out of diapers when The Killers released their first album, including including the hit song Somebody Told Me. Or, no, what's that song?
Somebody Told Me.
Yeah, Somebody Told Me. It's a good song, but
I don't know if this will make you proud or not, but I'm more than certain I discovered them when I had Rock Band as a kid. So for whatever that's worth.
Mr. Brightside, that's the song I'm thinking of, obviously. It's a great song.
Somebody Told Me is a bop too, so I'll go with either one.
It is. No, they're both good songs, but I was thinking of Mr. Brightside, which is the song that played every time I went dancing when I was in my early 20s, and it's the most nostalgic song I could possibly think of.
Wait, why have we never gone dancing anywhere?
Oh, because, well, most of the time we get together, it's at a trade show, and I don't really want to go dancing in Vegas.
I don't want to do anything in Vegas.
And there are things I'd rather do in Barcelona than go to a dance club, but you know.
I can't think of anything better to do, honestly. Go to a dance club with Daniel Bader. That sounds like a good time.
I would, you know what? This pandemic has changed me. It makes me want to go out so badly now. All I want to do is just go dancing in a sweaty club. Like it's weird what you want to do when you haven't done it. Like I never wanted to go dancing in a club even before this. I have a kid. I'm tired. I'm gross all the time. But somehow being stuck inside for 8 months really makes you want to do things that you used to love doing when you were in your early 20s. Funny how that works. Hayato, aside from dancing with me in a club, what's making you happy this week?
The idea that we could possibly name this episode I'm Sweaty and Gross All the Time.
Yes.
Jim, no.
No, but I've been doing a lot more covers on Instagram lately, which is not really something I generally have like time to actually put together. But I've been, you know, just doing some guitar covers and I posted a vocal cover the other day, and it's been a lot of fun to dabble in that stuff. And that's been making me pretty happy lately. I mean, I don't really have any kind of production background. I'm terrible with audio, but this sort of helps give me a little bit of practice. And of course it also gives me practice and a reason to practice when it comes to, you know, playing guitar and singing and all that stuff. So it's been a nice sort of exercise in a few different fields.
Man, that's great. Good for you. Art, do you have a...
Man, you're great.
Do you have a public Instagram? Can people actually find you on Instagram?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Okay, we'll leave it to you to decide whether you want to post it in the show notes. I'm not going to put you on the spot now.
I generally try not to share my Instagram with the tech side too much because I like having Instagram as my sort of like, you know, thing away from tech. But you know, if you just want to like listen to me playing and singing some spooky metal songs, that's fine.
So it's always a highlight when I've got an Instagram story update from you and it's a cover. So keep them coming 100%.
I guess what we're asking is if you do decide to follow Hayato, just don't harass him, okay? Just be nice.
Just don't ask me what phone you should buy. We write about that.
Instead, email him at... I'm not
yeah,
gonna do
that. Yeah, do that. We'll definitely get a response.
So yeah, going full circle from dancing in sweaty clubs in your early 20s to being a full-on dad, what's making me happy this week are Jeopardy reruns on Netflix. I don't know if this is a thing in the U.S., Do they have Jeopardy reruns on Netflix?
I think so, actually, yeah.
Okay, because they come in batches, and every once in a while, they just show up in my recommended feed as like, hey, there's a new collection, they call them, and it's usually like 5 or 6 episodes of one winner, and it'll just like show the first game, and then it'll go all the way to the end when they lose. And I don't know, man, it's just like watching 2 or 3 episodes of some really smart person winning in Jeopardy for an evening and then just like passing out is a really nice way to spend some time. And I highly recommend it because I actually do feel smarter after watching Jeopardy. I love Alex's, like watching a few episodes in a row, you can see just how absolutely savage he is at the beginning of every episode. He always insults the winner with a backhanded compliment. Every single time he'll be like, you know, I thought that Ryan was really going to lose. His answer in Final Jeopardy was just terrible, but somehow he managed to pull through, possibly because the other two contestants were just stupid. So welcome back, Ryan, and here are 2 new contestants. It's so good. He's really hilarious. There was an episode I watched last night where none of the contestants knew anything about football and the entire category was just about football. And Alex got so mad at them. He was like, guys, why don't you know anything about football? He made fun of them after every time nobody buzzed in. It was amazing. I highly recommend it.
I want to see that, but I also feel like I couldn't handle the secondhand shame because I also know nothing about football.
I don't know anything about football, but it was still amazing because
that's Alex, Jeopardy,
right? I mean, Alex is just like, he's so even keel most of the time, and then he goes off once in a while, and it's just good television. So, yeah. Anyway, Jeopardy reruns on, and also, I don't know about you, but it's just nice to watch a show where, like, it's pre-pandemic, you know, there's still social distancing happening, so you don't have to be like, wait, they just shook hands. They can't do that. there's nothing like, oh, they're not allowed to kiss, you know? It's kind of nice to have a very simple TV show to watch that doesn't remind you the world is about to end. Anyway, on that lovely high note, this has been the Android Central podcast.
Big yeet.
Well, I just want to thank you guys. It's been really fun. Thank you, audience, for tuning in. If you have any suggestions on what you want us to talk about, if you want us to answer any of your questions, if you just have any comments at all, always feel free to email us at podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. Joe is at JoeMaring1. Hayato is at Hayato Huseman. I am at Journey Dan. We are at Android Central. And this is another Android Central podcast. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. Bye-bye.
See ya.
See ya.